MacCast, Sunday, June 22nd, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me to talk about all things Apple, Mac, iOS, and all that other stuff. I almost said and beyond, just like we do on We Have Communicators. Almost stole Michael Johnson's line there. It was a little hard fighting that one. But anyway, glad to have you here with me for another episode. We got a lot of great stuff to talk about in this show. A lot of new information regarding, of course, OS X, Yosemite, and iOS 8. Also, some additional new information on iWatch, iPhone 6, and other Apple hardware rumors, as well as a new iMac to talk about. We've got that. Plus, a bunch of great feedback from you. I got to make a little correction on the stolen hard drive story that I gave you last week. I made a little faux pas there. We're going to correct that. Also, I got some great feedback on the split-screen iPhone and some weird issues with iTunes that one of our listeners is having. We're going to try and help them out with that. And also, I'm going to give you a little bit of a Yosemite preview trick you can maybe do in OS X Maverick, so you can get a little bit of that Yosemite feel without actually having to run the beta. I've got all that and a whole lot more to get to in this episode, but before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is lynda.com. You know, lynda.com is a site. It can help you learn and keep up to date with your software. It can help you pick up brand new skills, or maybe discover and explore a new hobby, and they do it with easy-to-follow-along video tutorials. They actually have 2,400 courses that are taught by industry experts, and they're adding more all the time. As a matter of fact, I just noticed that they had a new web course on Twitter Bootstrap 3. Many of you know I'm a web developer, so I've used lynda.com in the past to kind of keep up to date with my skills, so I'm definitely going to be checking out that one. And what I like about lynda.com is these are really high quality, high production value videos. They've got great audio, great video, great screencasts that you can actually see. So you never have to worry about the kind of training that you're getting. You're getting top quality stuff every single time. And they also cover all different skill levels. So it doesn't matter if you're an advanced user wanting to expand your skills on a topic, or if you're entering a brand new topic, if you're a novice and you just want to get up to speed, say on a new application that you're planning on using. And I've used lynda.com, and I find also a lot of the videos just to be inspirational, especially their creative and workflow videos. They really get you thinking about different topics and things like that. And another thing I really like about lynda.com is how they structure their videos. They're very well organized. They're broken down into sections, and you can track your progress. And what's great about that is that means that you can choose. If you have a lot of time, you can go straight through an entire course, spend a couple hours learning something new, or if you only have a little bit of time, you can jump in, get a little bite-sized bit, and then come back to it later when you have more time to finish the course. And the premium plans let you download the project files so you can practice along with the instructor. And you get all of this for one low monthly price of $25. It gives you unlimited access to the entire lynda.com video library. And then they have other plans, the premium parent plans and things like that, that go on from there. And best of all, MacCast listeners can get a free trial to the entire course library. You just go to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. to try it out, and I really think you're going to love it. So if you haven't checked out lynda.com, I encourage you to do so, and a big thank you to lynda.com for their support of the MacCast. I think without a doubt, coming off of WWDC in iOS 8 and OS 10 Yosemite, one of the things that a lot of us are excited about is the new continuity features, specifically things like the handoff feature that will allow you to move seamlessly from your iOS devices to your Mac and back and forth. So you can start an email on one device or platform and then move into the other one seamlessly. Or having the ability to pick up a phone call when you're on your Mac through your phone, or get an SMS or a text message directly on your Mac in the Messages application. Unfortunately, it's looking like there may be some limitations with the new handoff feature, at least with what we've seen so far in the last couple of betas. A report came out this week, and it showed that the handoff feature in OS X Yosemite may be limited to Macs and iOS devices that support Bluetooth LE. And if true, that means that there are many Macs that will be able to run OS X Yosemite, but will not get to use the handoff feature. And I think that really would be a bummer. Apple started introducing Bluetooth LE into Macs about mid-2011 or so. I think it started out with the MacBook Air models. And the Mac Pro, the latest version of the Mac Pro, is the last Mac lineup to get support for Bluetooth LE. Now, luckily, all iOS 8-supported devices are Bluetooth LE compatible. That's except for the iPad 2. But on the Mac side, you're looking at mid-2011 MacBook Airs, mid-2012 MacBook Pros, and that includes all of the Retina MacBook Pros. So that's these are the entry-level models, these models and later. So mid-2011 MacBook Air, mid-2012 MacBook Pro and later, the late 2012 iMacs and later, mid-2011 Mac Minis and later, and then, of course, the 2013 Mac Pro models. All of these are going to be able to function with the handoff functionality in OS X Yosemite. Now, if you'd like to actually check and determine if your Mac's Bluetooth version does support Bluetooth LE, iMore had a great little tip. You can simply click on the Apple menu and then go to About This Mac and then click on the More Info button and then click on the System Report button. And then once that window opens up, the System Report, you want to expand the section for Bluetooth from the sidebar. And you'll find that underneath the hardware section. Scan down the list of information until you find the LMP version. And if your Mac is equipped with support for Bluetooth 4.0 LE, the LMP version will say 0x6 or higher. I think 0x6 is the latest version. Anything lower than that means that you have an older version of the Bluetooth and you're not going to be able to support Bluetooth LE. So, if you have a non-supported Mac, you could be pretty disappointed when OS X Yosemite launches, especially if you were looking forward to those handoff features. Now, all might not be lost because 9to5 Mac claims that they have some sources with, quote, knowledge on the matter who are saying that Apple is still testing the features of handoff and that it really has not finalized which models will be supported at launch yet. So really what we're seeing reported right now is the models that are currently supported in Apple just released the second beta, and we're going to be talking about that in a second. So through the second beta, this is sort of what's been supported so far. And even if things remain as they are, 9to5 is also reporting that there is some indication that you possibly would be able to use a Bluetooth LE adapter, like a little USB adapter, and maybe gain compatibility on an older Mac for the handoff functionality. One tester, as a matter of fact, already claims to have been able to do that using the current betas of OS X Yosemite. So I think a lot of us are really excited about handoff, and hopefully Apple will be able to expand it so that all of the Macs and iOS devices that are capable of running OS X Yosemite and iOS 8 will be able to take advantage of that functionality. But only time's going to tell on that. But it does sound, at least for now, like it's limited to Bluetooth LE devices. Apple and the Apple community is having a bit of a scare this past week because it's looking like Samsung, what I'm going to call the Samsung zombies, are going after Siri's brains. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that Samsung is currently in talks or has been in talks with Nuance to possibly do an acquisition. Now, if that's true, it could be frightening for Apple because they use Nuance technology to drive the speech and dictation recognition algorithms for Siri. It's a big part of the Siri technology. And if Nuance were to be acquired, it really is uncertain what that actually would mean for Apple and Siri. I think under the very best scenario, Apple would be reliant on Samsung for another core bit of their technology. And really, that's not a position Apple wants to be in. I think they've been trying to separate themselves further and further from Samsung. The worst case scenario is Apple would actually have to go out and find some other provider for the speech recognition technology or be forced to develop their own technology in-house. Now, one of the things I find interesting about this story, and something that also just sort of illustrates how reliant Apple has been on nuanced technology, is they, back in 2011, had reportedly attempted to actually acquire Nuance, but the deal really never happened. And at that time, the deal was said to be somewhere in the range of a $5 to $6 billion deal. So almost twice what Apple just paid for the Beats deal. And obviously, I think now it would be a lot more to acquire Nuance. So Apple would have to spend a pretty penny of their cash on hand to actually pick up Nuance if they wanted to. But the good news is that they actually might not have to. And that worst case scenario I was mentioning, where they might have to develop their own technology in-house, that actually might not be all that bad, because it seems like they've been preparing for that a little bit. In 2013, there was a report that suggested that Apple may already be working to move Siri development in-house. And supposedly, they had developed a dedicated team of Siri engineers over in Boston who were all working on a voice recognition solution. You may have remembered this story from back last year. And also in April, it was discovered by TechCrunch that Apple had acquired a company called Novaris almost a year ago, although the information just came to light over the last couple months. And Novaris is a company founded with many of the members of the team from Dragon Systems R&D branch in the UK, Dragon Systems R&D UK LTD. And that is the research subsidiary of Dragon Systems. And if you're recognizing that Dragon name, Dragon Systems actually made Dragon Dictate and the Dragon Naturally Speaking software. And they were an early pioneer of all of this modern voice technology and recognition systems. Now, of course, Nuance now owns the Dragon Dictate and Dragon Naturally Speaking software. But the Novaris team has been developing their own large vocabulary automatic speech recognition technology, and they supposedly have systems that work both with embedded systems as well as in the server space, and they've developed their own core engine. And so Apple has had those folks in-house along with their own Siri team in Boston for quite a while, so I have to imagine that they've been working on some various technologies. And it's also important to remember that Nuance obviously isn't the only technology that drives Siri. A lot of the integrated services and things like that, things like Yelp, Wolfram Alpha, Bing, Yahoo, all of those other data services, now Shazam and iOS 8, all of that stuff goes into making up Siri's quote-unquote intelligence, right? But the Nuance piece is a pretty important piece, because that's the thing that parses your voice and actually allows you to gain access to that information. It's the kind of the technology that Siri uses to be able to understand us. So if these rumors are true, my first thought was, I really hope that Apple's willing to shell out a big chunk of money so that they can actually acquire Nuance and sort of keep that technology in their own hands and make it available for Siri. But after learning some of these other things, specifically about the Novaris acquisition, it seems to me like Apple has been planning for this probably since when they tried to acquire Nuance and for whatever reason weren't able to do so. And I think we all know that Apple really likes to own the whole widget, and that didn't work out for them. So what they do or did, and this is what they often do, is they started building out their own internal team. And it may be that their secret in-house team is now currently far enough along and strong enough and has enough mature technology that Apple is really no longer dependent on Nuance, and Apple probably knows it. So it may be that we don't even see Apple trying to go after Nuance, that they sort of just let them fall by the wayside and slowly bring in their own technology. This is what we saw them do with Apple Maps. Now, they had to scramble a little bit more on Apple Maps. This seems like it would be a much simpler and easier, potentially easier transition. Again, we don't know how far along they are, how much they've been working on, and those sorts of things. But the fact that Nuance is out talking to folks like Samsung also seems to hint that they're shopping themselves around. And it may be because they know that their relationship with Apple these days isn't as strong as it used to be. And, you know, a significant part of their value, or at least portion of their value is really dependent on licensing that nuanced technology to companies like Apple. So maybe they want to get sold when they are sort of looking good and pretty. And if Apple were to leave, I'm sure it would have an impact on sort of the valuation of Nuance. So it's an interesting story to watch and follow along. But I think now at this point, I wouldn't be surprised if Apple came out and said, you know what, we're bringing our own Siri technology in-house with our own engineers, and it's going to be bigger and better than it ever was under Nuance. For the next couple weeks, months, I don't think a show is going to go by where we're not going to be able to talk about the latest iWatch and iPhone 6 rumors. So let's start with the iWatch. We're starting to hear information from component production. It's actually starting to kick up right now, and we're getting rumors from suppliers like Largan, Foxconn, Pegatron, Quanta, Eventtech, and FTPK, a lot of the names we've heard from in the past. One of the latest is on the iWatch is that the screen may be a little bit different than we thought. It's now being reported that it is an OLED display. We'd heard a little bit about that, but there was sort of back and forth. And we're also hearing once again that the current prototypes may be having some production issues. Specifically this time around, Apple's not completely happy with the power consumption. We know that Apple wants to get a good battery life out of the iWatch, and power is going to be a big, big factor in that. So getting the most efficient display, and supposedly they're having some problems with a few of the prototypes. But one of the issues may be that the latest rumors on the screen indicate it is big, much bigger than was originally thought. The display is reportedly a 2.5-inch display, and unlike the rumors we were hearing last week, it's not going to be round, at least according to the rumors this week. It's always constantly changing, constantly in flux. But right now they're saying it's going to be slightly rectangular, that the watch face will actually protrude slightly from the band, creating sort of an arch-type shape. So we had sort of heard rumors that it may be slightly curved or curved, so it might have to sort of wrap around, especially if it is that big. 2.5 inches is really pretty big. And I was sort of actually disappointed to hear this rumor, because I think a round display is much more classic, much more stylish, and would seem to me be more the kind of device that Apple would want to put out. The square ones just tend to be big and horsey. I mean, think of what the all of the sort of watch designs that were put around, the watch case designs that were put around the iPod Nano, right? The little square iPod Nano. Yeah, it made it into sort of a functional watch, and it was a cool concept, but I think hardly anybody could argue that a lot of those were fashionable. Maybe some of the metal bands, metal and leather kind of things looked pretty nice, but they're still pretty huge and honking. So it had been being speculated that Apple was going to go with a 1.3 to a 1.7-inch screen. We were also hearing rumors that there might be multiple sizes so that they could appeal to men and women. And to me, those rumors made a lot of sense. And when I heard this 2.5-inch screen rumor, I thought, wow, that's going to be really big. And as a matter of fact, a Mac Rumors forum member, Louis Dorigo, pointed out that, you know, there's some things that make sense with a 2.5-inch-ish display. One of them is that at 480 by 460 resolution, if Apple did a 2.4-inch display, that would have a pixel density of about 326 ppi. So that would be right in that retina range that Apple likes to use. But Louis actually did a little bit of a mock-up and showed how that would look on his wrist. And it is, in my opinion, horsey. It's really, really too big. But we'll have to see. Maybe Apple wants to have, you know, enough screen real estate so that it's actually functional and usable. When you start getting to a smaller display, it could be a little bit more challenging. But I see that as kind of a challenge that Apple would normally want to go after, right? How to figure out a proper UI for a smaller screen for that kind of device. And it's certainly in something that's in Apple's ability to actually be able to solve. But it's also being said that the iWatch will have wireless charging, and that, again, Apple is kind of struggling with battery life issues, that they want the battery life on the iWatch to be able to last days. Some of the latest reports I had heard was that they were getting 1 to 2 days of battery life, and that's just not acceptable. It's going to be nice if it does have a wireless charging system, because that means you're not going to have to connect any kind of cable. Although one of the things I think about every time I hear this is like, how many wireless chargers am I going to have to buy? Right? Am I going to have one for my office and one for my living room and one for my bedroom? Maybe it's a profit center a little bit for Apple. You know, it's easy to just move and carry a cord around, but your wireless, you know, sort of base stations for charging, I don't think you're going to want to have to move those around all the time. I guess it really depends, again, on the design and the size of that sort of thing. But I think even if it's something like, think of an iPod dock or even like an iPod Shuffle dock, I don't like to move those things around too much. It's much easier just to kind of carry around my cables. So who knows if it'll also have some sort of connector and cable charging option. But right now, a lot of the reports are saying it is going to be wireless. The Wall Street Journal also published a new report this week claiming that Apple's upcoming entry into the smartwatch market is going to support more than 10 sensors for collecting health data and information. We knew that Apple was really investing and sort of doubling down on sensors. Tim Cook talked about it at the D conference that he felt sensors were going to be really important moving forward. We're hearing rumors that the iWatch is going to actually be capable of measuring not only heart rate and steps and all those sorts of things, but also blood pressure, potentially blood glucose monitoring, even sweat and hydration, those sorts of things. You get 10 sensors in that thing, and I can't even think of 10 sensors that would be in there. So it'll be really interesting to see what comes forth. Also being reported is that Apple is working, at least by the Wall Street Journal, is working on multiple versions of the device. And I would, again, think that meant multiple sizes. So that sort of contradicts a little bit in my mind the 2.5-inch display rumor. Another thing that kind of contradicts that, as I was alluding to earlier, is the whole style thing. Apple has supposedly been inviting athletes from the MLB, from the NHL and NBA into Cupertino to help out with testing of the iWatch device. As a matter of fact, there were some photos recently of Los Angeles Lakers player Kobe Bryant on the Apple campus. So that seems to prop up the rumors that Apple might be bringing, you know, pro athletes in to kind of take a look at the watch and help them test it out. And I think it also falls in line with Apple's Beats purchase, because part of the idea, I think, behind Apple purchasing Beats is to get that kind of cachet with a younger audience and also get in with the whole Hollywood sports stars and things like that. We've heard and seen lots of athletes wearing Beats headphones. It's a big part of their marketing. And I think Apple wants to leverage that marketing impact, especially with the younger demographic. It's like, it's a really big deal. And the iWatch is going to play right into that. It's really going to be as much about being a brand, fashion, and image statement as it is about the health and fitness applications. And if, you know, young people see their favorite sports stars and athletes and musicians all wearing iWatches or Beats headphones, that goes a long way to influencing purchase decisions and sort of keeping Apple relevant in that space in the market. So I think that's a good move for Apple to be sort of looking at that angle when it comes to a device like the iWatch. And another thing we've been hearing that seems to be important for Apple with any kind of fitness and health device is going to be FDA approval and certification, something that we've not seen any of Apple's competitors who are rushing products to market really attempt. And a Chinese website is claiming that the iWatch is taking a bit longer because Apple wants to seek FDA approval for the device. Apple would need that kind of approval if they want to integrate things like the glucose meter. So all those sensors plus this sort of rumor seems to indicate, and also the stuff we saw from HealthKit at WWDC seems to really indicate that Apple is looking to have their product, their entry into the space, really be certified as a serious medical device and something that I think doctors can help and can use and can be helped to monitor patients and things like that, and really provide maybe some more preventative type healthcare. You know, we can get into some of the privacy concerns and those sorts of things. I'm sure Apple has a plan for that as well, and we'll be addressing that. And ultimately, I think what it will come down to in a lot of cases is the sort of opt-in model, right? You don't have to opt in to share this information and data with your healthcare providers or with your doctors, but you will have the option, especially if Apple can get FDA approval in the device and meet all the HIPAA requirements and all the privacy requirements and those sorts of things. And I think, you know, they are taking a bit longer than some of their other competitors to try and make sure that all of that stuff is done right and kind of done the Apple way. Again, the kind of classic way we've always seen Apple operate when it comes to these things. They're not always first, but they do try to be the best. And as far as being the best, I think one aspect of that too, getting back to kind of the design and fashion aspect of the iWatch, is materials. And Johnny Ive hinted recently during an interview that Apple has been working with new materials for several years and that those materials are about to show up in some future products. Now, he didn't go any further into saying exactly what those materials are or which products they will be in, of course, but we can speculate and guess a little bit. I mean, Apple's been playing around and has had exclusive rights to the liquid metal technology. We haven't really seen them implement that in any kind of big way. A lot of that had to do with, I guess, issues with ramping up production. It's been several years now, so I think it might be entirely possible that we see some liquid metal in some of Apple's newer products, specifically maybe in the casing of the iWatch. Also, sapphire glass. Apple's used it in little places, the Touch ID sensor and the lens, but we've heard all those reports that it's very likely going to show up in the display for the iPhone, and I would guess also for the covering for the iWatch. Apple's hopefully addressed some of the breakability issues because sapphire is said to be more breakable or more susceptible to breakage than the Gorilla Glass that Apple's currently using, but we know that sapphire has a much better scratch resistance. So if Apple can get those two things together, they're going to have a killer product on their hand. And as far as price point for the iWatch, the latest rumors we're hearing are that the price point may be a little bit in the higher range, something we've also come to expect from Apple, $349 US when it hits the market, and that Apple is wanting to have 10 million units ready at launch. They expect to sell about 10 million this year, and then there are also reports saying that long-term, over the next year, Apple's hoping to sell as many as 50 million units of the iWatch in the first year of sales. And it's expected that the iWatch will be announced sometime in October and will be shipping in the fourth quarter of this year. Now moving on to the latest iPhone 6 rumors. We're hearing that the 4.7-inch model will use displays from LG Display and Japan Display, suppliers Apple has used in the past. The glass on the 4.7-inch model may end up actually being Gorilla Glass and not Sapphire. Now, this is one rumor that I'm not quite ready to believe yet. We've been hearing so much about Apple developing the Sapphire Glass technology, and more recently we've heard that GT Advanced Technologies has more than enough production capacity and capability with their Mesa, Arizona plant to actually supply the glass, not only for 4.7-inch iPhones, but also for the rumored 5.5-inch model and beyond. So I think Apple is going to still go with the Sapphire Glass, but this week we heard maybe not on the 4.7-inch model. Now, related to that, there was a filing submitted to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission that showed that GT Advanced Technologies may be ramping up a second Sapphire Glass manufacturing facility in Salem, Massachusetts. It's actually a 50,000-square-foot facility that they already had and were doing R&D in, but the company has reportedly used some of Apple's investment money to actually purchase and install the same kinds of furnaces that they have in the plant in Mesa, Arizona, in that facility. So the speculation is that Apple and GT could now use that facility to supplement Sapphire Glass production, although it's not 100% clear that that is what they're intending to do. It could just end up being a sort of testing facility. It could be just expanding that R&D effort. But analyst Matt Margolis said that now that facility could supply up to an additional 20 million Sapphire screens per year. So that brings the total to 220 million screens per year, at least for GT's production capabilities. And that reportedly would be more than enough for all of Apple's iPhone devices and iWatches, things like that. 60 million 4.7-inch iPhone units are expected to be available at launch. I would imagine a similar number, if not more, of the 5.5-inch model. The 5.5 8-inch model is still rumored to be featuring a sapphire crystal screen, but supposedly Apple is having some kind of yield issues, and they're expecting the quantities and supplies to be low through the end of the year. Is that really surprising to anyone? These are the same kind of rumors we hear every single time. But again, that sort of contradicts this report we've been hearing that the Mesa, Arizona plant can produce 200 million displays a year. That seems hardly constrained to me, but maybe it's the kind of case where ultimately they can produce that many, but right now they just haven't been able to ramp up the manufacturing as fast as possible. And I guess if that is the case, then maybe Apple will opt to only have the Sapphire displays on the more premium 5.5-inch model. I'm really hoping that that's not the case, because I really am not interested, and I think we've talked about this a little bit, in the 5.5-inch iPhone. I think it's way too big. But if Apple is going to make serious distinctions in terms of features and functionality between the two, and if the 5.5-inch from a technology standpoint is a much superior phone, then I think myself and a lot of folks are going to opt for that device, even if they feel it might not be the perfect sized device for them. I always want to have the latest and greatest, because that's just the kind of person I am. I mean, aren't we all, right? If you're listening to this show, you're probably a lot like me. The average consumer probably is not going to care too much whether their phone has Gorilla Glass or Sapphire Glass. They're just going to care that it doesn't break and doesn't scratch. So I can see Apple going that route, but I don't think supplies are going to be constrained because of Sapphire Glass. And I do think Sapphire Glass will be used, if at all possible, on both the 4.7 and 5.5-inch model. The one thing that I think is going to constrain supplies of the 5.5-inch, or just the iPhone 6 in general, is huge, huge demand. Everything is indicating that because Apple's going to launch finally a larger screen iPhone, that demand for the iPhone 6 is going to be bigger than ever. And I think that rumor is very likely to come true. And then finally, there's also code references in the latest iOS betas that seem to indicate the iPhone 6 may get a new sensor. Huh, surprise. Tim Cook said sensors are the next big thing. We're hearing now that the sensor may be a barometer, which could be used for altitude and weather pressure sensing. So more accurate weather. You can also track your altitude when you're hiking, things like that. And a barometer could also be useful with Apple's indoor mapping and iBeacon technology. So if you're at a mall, something like that, it could help in determining which floor you're on. It also could help with Apple's indoor mapping efforts. So that's kind of the latest on the iPhone 6. Apple this week pushed out the second round of betas for iOS and OS X out to developers. iOS 8 Beta 2 came out, and of course, we're getting details on all the juicy tidbits that are in there. One of them that I was particularly excited about, because I have iOS 8 Beta 2 installed on my older iPad, is QuickType keyboard support for the iPad. That wasn't in there in the original release, so I haven't been able to play around with that. I'm hoping to do that a little bit, and hopefully I can share my thoughts and impressions there. Another interesting thing for podcasters is the podcast app is now installed as a default app and can't be removed. This was actually something in Beta 1 that they did with the iBooks application. So prior to iOS 8, both the podcast app and the iBooks app were separate downloads. It was recommended when you first booted your device that you actually downloaded and installed them, but they weren't required and they weren't built in, and you can actually remove them at any point. It's looking like Apple is now making those standard applications as part of the pre-installed suite. Safari now has the ability to block ads that automatically redirect users to the App Store without any interaction. So excited about that one, because I hate it when I click a link not realizing that it's actually an App Store link and it jumps me over there. So the ability to stop that is going to be really, really nice. And another nice new item in Safari is you now have the ability on the iPad to actually pinch in to access your tabs. So no longer having to go up and click the little or tap on the little button. You can just do a little pinch gesture and jump right into your tab browsing, or tab view rather. And another nice little addition to Safari is you'll now have the ability to actually save a shared link or bookmark by tapping and holding on the bookmarks button in the browser. The camera and voice buttons got a little bit of a UI update in iOS 8 Messages app. They've been changed from a blue color to just simply a gray color, so a little bit more subtle and muted. And something really nice in the notification center, it appears you now have the ability to toggle off all of an app's notifications right from one button. So you don't have to go in and pick all the individual things like, no, I don't want it on the notification screen. No, I don't want you to badge the app icon. No, I don't want you to do the sound. You can now just go into settings, notifications, select the app, and right there at the top, there's a little toggle that says allow notifications. You flip that to off, and you will get no notifications of any kind from that application. Of course, there were also some other bug fixes and improvements, including a fix to the screen brightness slider in the settings, where that wasn't sticking, I don't think. And then also an update to prevent crashing when adding third-party keyboards, which are actually starting to show up using Apple's new third-party keyboard API. So if you're a lucky developer that has access to one of those third-party keyboards and we're experiencing crashes with that, that supposedly has been fixed in this latest beta. Another cool, little more visual feature that showed up in iOS Beta 2 is in the Maps application. And this was actually something that was part of what I call that feature cloud slide at WWDC. So it wasn't officially announced, but if you were paying attention, that slide with all of the iOS 8 features comes up at the end of the iOS 8 section. And one of the things on there was flyover city tours. And a developer has figured out how to use a hidden debug menu in the latest iOS beta to actually release and activate access to that. And he posted a video on Forever Mac of a flyover tour of Paris. So what this does is in the flyover view, it goes from sort of interest point to interest point and walks you through a kind of virtual tour of various cities. And right now it looks like the feature is activated and available for Paris, as well as Barcelona, Rome, Stockholm, New York, Glasgow, Cape Town, Perth, Bordeaux, and San Francisco. Now, luckily, it seemed like you kind of had to find this hidden debug menu to actually access the functionality. Until just today, I saw a report that said you can actually access the city tour if you know specifically where to tap. So if you're running iOS 8 Beta 2, and I tried this on my iPad already, and it's pretty cool, you just go to one of those cities, zoom into the level where you see the name of the city in yellow text, and tap right on the yellow text, and you should get a little pop-up for the flyover city tour. And you can tap on the little blue city tour icon, and off it goes. It'll sort of walk you through. And basically, it zooms into the different points of interest in flyover view, and then kind of does a little pan around, about 45-degree pan around the interest point, and then zooms back out, and then moves on to the next interest point. Right now, there's no kind of narration or any kind of labeling or text flyouts or information, things like that. But I'm hoping they'll maybe add some of that, because I'd like to kind of know a little bit about what I'm looking at, especially if they could pull in maybe some information from Wikipedia and some other sources, maybe some additional photos, those sorts of things. That would be really nice. I don't know if any of that's planned for right now, but maybe something they could add in future enhancements. So that's some of the latest and greatest in iOS 8 Beta 2. Now let's talk about the second beta of OS 10 Yosemite. It looks like finally you can enable the dark mode, although Apple still hasn't added any kind of toggle for it. You will have to jump into the terminal and do a little terminal hacking. I'll have a link to the command in the show notes at maccast.com, but it's the typical defaults right hack that you do. You just need to turn on one of the global preferences for the Apple interface theme and set it to dark. You can actually change it back by just switching the word in the command from dark to light. Seems pretty obvious. But the feature is reportedly not quite fully baked, so even if you enable it, it still seems to have some display issues according to reports. For example, the menu bar icons have little borders around them. So that's probably likely why Apple has not enabled it in the GUI yet in terms of turning it on as a setting. Apple has also added a new field for continuity support in the system information under the Bluetooth category. So you have some new options in there to so you can tell if your device supports continuity, including instead of having to do the cryptic sort of Bluetooth low energy check we talked about earlier in OS X Yosemite, you can go into the system information, look under Bluetooth, and you'll see Bluetooth low energy supported, yes or no. You'll also have entry for continuity supported as well as AirDrop supported. So if you want to know if your device supports that functionality in OS X Yosemite, that'll be quick and easy to do. Max, with the new Yosemite beta on the same network as Apple TVs, also got a surprise. If those Apple TVs were running the latest iOS beta, developers noticed that when they installed both the latest updates on their devices, that they received an Apple TV is now available for continuity pop-up on their Mac. It's not clear at this point what continuity features would be supported on the Apple TV, but just the fact that any are going to be supported is an interesting new bit of information. I would imagine possibly features like the handoff feature, so you'd be able to move seamlessly audio and video content from your device or your Mac over to your Apple TV. So rather than having to actually pull up the AirPlay button and send it over, your Apple TV could simply pop up and say, hey, we noticed you're watching this movie on your iPhone. Do you want to watch it on your Apple TV? You could click yes and away you go. Another possible application would be the handoff feature for your phone calls via your phone. So you'd be able to see incoming phone call data, know that you're getting a phone call as you're watching your Apple TV, and possibly, I would imagine even at some point, allow you to pick up and respond to the call. We've heard rumors that Apple might build things like microphones into the Apple TV remote. The Apple TV itself could get an EyeSight camera. So future updates of the Apple TV may support additional kind of continuity and handoff features. And it seems like the operating systems are building in support for that right now. So that's the kind of the latest on the latest versions of iOS 8 and the OS X Yosemite beta. Apple finally did drop the new lower-priced iMac that we had been hearing rumored about the past couple of weeks, and it may or may not be what you were expecting. It certainly wasn't what I was expecting. Apple added a new 21.5-inch model to the bottom end of their iMac lineup with a new lower price. The new model comes with a 1.4 gigahertz dual-core Intel Core i5 CPU, a 500-gigabyte hard drive, 8 gigabytes of RAM, and Intel HD Graphics 5000, and is priced at $1099 US, $200 less than the current base model. It's basically, if you look at the specs, a MacBook Air with a 21.5-inch screen and a 500-gigabyte hard drive rather than the solid-state flash storage. And OWC discovered through a teardown that it's like the MacBook Air in another way. That is that the 8 gigabytes of RAM is actually soldered on and is non-user upgradable. So if you want to get more RAM, you really don't have an option because RAM in the new model is also not user configurable. So it's what you see is what you get with this new iMac model. As far as performance goes, the single core benchmarking shows it slightly higher than the MacBook Air in terms of performance, about 12% higher using a single core, and it's just slightly lower than the next model up, the 2.7 gigahertz quad-core i5 iMac in terms of performance on a single core. But things get really different when you bump up to multi-core processing. The new iMac is actually 40% slower than its 2.7 gigahertz sibling in the multi-core tests, according to MacNN. And remember, that next bump up is just $200. So you don't get a lot of savings for quite a dip in performance with this new model. So to me, the new model is a little bit puzzling, and I think it's mostly a psychological and marketing price point more so than a practical one. I think I'd find it very hard to actually recommend the new cheaper iMac to anyone. If you're going to go that route, in my opinion, you'd almost be better off just going for a MacBook Air and then hooking up an external monitor. You can get the much more powerful 2.7 gigahertz Core i5 model with a 1 terabyte hard drive a dedicated NVIDIA graphics card, the GeForce GT 640, and it's $200 more from Apple. But if you actually do some shopping around, some sites noted that you can actually get that version of the iMac as low as $999 US with some rebates, so a full $100 cheaper than Apple will even sell you that new lower base priced model. Now, that being said, that's just a complaint from tech geeks like me, people like us who kind of pay attention to these sorts of things. I have to tell you, in the consumer marketplace, though, that price point is going to be key. Apple is likely going to sell a lot of this model. It's got that big, gorgeous 21.5-inch screen. And most people, if they're web surfing and doing email, it's more machine than they're actually going to need on their desktop. So I don't think Apple's going to have any trouble selling them. It's a very attractive price point, and it should do very well for them. I just think, as tech geeks, it's our responsibility when friends and family ask to tell them, you know, just spend the extra $200 and you're going to get a little more bang for your buck. You're going to have the ability to upgrade your RAM, and you'll likely get a little more longevity out of that system. Now, Apple didn't stop the price drops just with the iMac, at least for those of you who are over in the UK and Europe. You get the benefit of some additional price drops on the iMac models. They've been cut between 100 euro and 200 euros, or about $169 to $339 US, depending upon which configuration you get. Apple also dropped the price of the Mac Minis a little bit, up to 60 euros, about $81 US. And Apple TVs are now going to cost you a little bit less in the UK, just 79 euros, about $134 US, which is a 20 euro price drop from the previous price of 99 euros. If you're the type of person who likes to save money on cheap cables and cheap chargers, and you own an iPhone 5, you're going to want to listen to this last story in the news for this week. According to the UK repair site Mend My Eye, they've been doing a little investigating on some of the iPhone 5 repairs they've been seeing. They say that they've seen an influx of devices coming in with an issue where they won't charge past 1%, or they won't boot up at all after the battery was drained completely. And they say the issue could be connected to cheap chargers and USB cables. The theory is that the chargers and cables are damaging the internal U2 IC chip. That's the one that sits on the logic board of the iPhone 5 and regulates the power and charging, things like that. Mend My Eye says that the third-party chargers or USB cables that don't regulate well enough the power and voltage and current, those can actually damage the U2 IC chip, and that's what their findings seem to indicate. They said they can replace the battery in the unit, and then the iPhone will come back to life, but the minute that that battery depletes down again and you have to go back to charge it, you run into the same kind of issues. It won't charge past 1%, or if you've drained it all the way down to the point where the power's gone off, it won't power back up without replacing the battery. So once you've damaged the chip, really the only solution is a new logic board or actually replacing the chip, which is not a simple repair. So far, they say they've only seen this problem on the iPhone 5. It's not clear whether or not the issue would impact other model iPhones or iPads, although the iPhone 5S, it did note, has a different U2 IC component than the iPhone 5, so it may be just restricted to that model. The site claims that even if you're using auto car chargers, you want to be careful because those also don't tend to regulate the current and voltage. That said, I have to tell you, my wife and I have used car chargers and third-party chargers made for iPhone certified chargers, but still third-party chargers with our devices, including the iPhone 5, for years without issue. The Mend My Eye site said you should consider, if you're powering in the car, using a high-quality power inverter and actually plugging into like a standard socket the Apple supplied charger and cable for charging in the car. That to me seems a bit cumbersome and a little unwieldy, but if you're really worried about this issue, you might consider that. You also probably only want to use the Apple supplied charging brick and Apple branded cables if you're really paranoid about it. They say that most customers are unaware of the issue until they've actually let the battery in their device drain completely to zero, and at that point it will no longer power up. That's when they're bringing them in. Now, I'm also going to point out that Mend My Eye does offer to do and can repair the issue of replacing that IC chip. And I have no doubt that they believe this issue exists, but I also want to point out and recognize that they do have something to gain from their own findings and their own report. I'm not saying that they're doing that. I think there probably is an issue here. I don't doubt it, but you have to always consider the source when you're reading these reports. So with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. This week, I want to talk about PDF Pen for iPad. I love PDF Pen for iPad. I use it all the time for opening, editing, managing, changing PDFs. I use a lot for digitally signing my documents. I think I've mentioned on the show, I'm trying to go completely paperless with all my workflows. So if I'm out and about and I get a document that needs a signature, I know I can pop it into PDF Pen, open it up. And big news right now, PDF Pen for iPad now has transporter integration. So if you own a transporter, if you use the transporter application, you can access your PDFs right off of your own private secure transporter private cloud. So if you need to sign that contract, you need to fix a typo, you need to get at your documents, you can manage them all there. Of course, PDF Pen still has and has had support for other cloud services like iCloud and Dropbox. You can sync all your PDFs through that service, through those services. You can also grab and save your PDFs from Evernote and Google Drive and Box and now Transporter. So whatever device you have for managing that stuff, you can get at your PDFs and have them when and where you need them. You can edit them anywhere, do highlighting, annotating, make small text changes, fill out forms, even create and fill out forms that PDF forms that aren't actually PDF forms, what I like to call fake forms, basically where you have that line, but it's really not a form field. You can put your own in and fill that out and send it back. Go completely paperless. True mobile editing power for PDFs on your iPad. I think it's an invaluable application. If you deal with PDFs at all, you should have PDF Pen, not just for the iPad, but for the Mac as well. You can find it on the App Store, on the Mac App Store. And now with the transporter integration, if you don't have a transporter, you might take a look at the transporter sync, which can take any USB external hard drive and turn it into your own private cloud just for $99. You have no monthly fees and you can store as much as your hard drive will store because it's your own drive. Transporter and transporter sync are available from filetransporter.com. PDF Pen, of course, is available from smilesoftware.com. And while you're there, check out all of the other great applications that Smile makes. PDF Pen for your desktop, Text Expander, both for your Mac and your iOS devices. And be sure to check out PDF Pen Scan Plus for your iOS devices as well. Huge fan of Smile. They've been a huge supporter of the MacCast over the years. So show your support for them by checking out their products and picking up a copy of any one of them. And a big thank you to Smile Software for their support of the MacCast. One of the things I do on the MacCast and have done for years is try and make sure that the information that I get for you is well-researched and accurate. And I think most of the time I do a pretty good job, but over the years, every once in a while, I will make a mistake. And so this past week, I actually made one of those mistakes, actually a pretty big one. And it was the story we were talking about, a MacCast listener who had had his hard drive stolen literally out of his laptop when he was on vacation and replaced with a blank formatted drive. And he was asking about, am I protected if I have user accounts with usernames and passwords set up on the device and I'm not doing the whole auto login thing? And I had said that he would be, you know, fairly well protected by having the password in there, meaning that someone couldn't just take the drive, pop it in a new Mac, and then boot up and get right into his accounts. Well, that wasn't really accurate. And I think part of my mistake was made because I knew that Apple had removed at least the visual part of the reset password feature from the recovery partition on the Mac graphic user interface. And so it used to be that if you wanted to reset the admin password on your hard drive, you could actually do that by booting to your macOS 10 DVD. And then right in there, there was a reset admin password option. And you could literally just reset the admin password. And I think that made it into the first version of the recovery partition. But starting in OS 10 Mavericks, and maybe a little bit earlier, but I know for sure in OS X Mavericks, you don't have that access to that graphic user interface. But the feature actually is still there and can be still be accessed if you know how to do it. So if you restart the Mac, you hold down the Command and R key on booting to go in the recovery partition, you'll see a window for OS X utilities. When that comes up, if you go up to the menu bar and from the utilities menu select terminal, you can bring up a terminal window. And if you, at the prompt, type reset password and hit return, it will pop open that reset password window and dialog that you used to have. And from there, you can actually reset and enter a new admin password. You just put in a new password, verify it, click save, and now you have full admin access to that drive. Once you're done, you just quit utilities, and it will reboot the Mac, and away you go. You're in there, and you have access to everything. So that was one way. That's even more complicated, though, than the other thing several of you pointed out, is that there's an easier way to access the data on that drive. Literally, if you took that stolen drive and put it into a USB enclosure, or maybe used a USB drive adapter, connected it directly to another Mac via USB, it's now acting as an external drive. And one of the things you can do in the Finder with external drives is you can select that drive, do a file get info, a command I on the drive, and right there in the window, there's a checkbox that says ignore permissions on this drive. You check that on, and now you have access to any of the files on that drive that are unencrypted. So this particular user had not used File Vault or any kind of encryption on the drive. So really that data, once the drive has been compromised, once it's a thief or somebody has physical access, if it's not encrypted, there are several ways to get in. And I didn't really make that clear and actually said pretty much the opposite. So that was a huge mistake on my part, and I apologize for that. So where that leaves us is really the best way to protect your data from any kind of attack is to make sure you use some form of whole disk encryption. And the easiest way to do that with a Mac is File Vault 2. It's built right into OS X Mavericks. You literally just have to flip it on, and your entire hard drive will be encrypted. So if you want to do this, the first thing you want to do is make sure that you make a backup of your drive. Nothing really should go wrong. This is pretty robust and solid technology, at least now. File Vault 1 was a little iffy, but most people I talk to who use File Vault 2 have said they have had no issues with it. But just in case, back up your drive with, you know, do a backup. That backup will, of course, be unencrypted at this point, but you'll have it just in case. And then once you've done that, you just go into System Preferences, go into the Security and Privacy System Preference pane, and into File Vault. You'll need to click the little padlock on the lower left corner and authenticate with your admin username and password, but then at that point you can turn on File Vault. You just flip the switch. It will use your account credentials to do the encryption, so nothing will really change for you in terms of the login process. When you boot up your Mac, you'll log in. That will allow you access to the drive. When you're logged out, though, File Vault encryption will be on, and your whole drive, all of the data, will actually be encrypted. Once you turn it on for the first time, Apple is going to show you a recovery key. It's important that you take note of that, copy it, put it in a safe place, maybe put it in your 1Password database, which has a separate encryption, and log in, so you can stick it in there, or you could print it out, put it in a safe. You'll want that just in case you ever forget your Mac's admin password, because once you've enabled File Vault, you're not going to be able to do that whole reset password trick. The only way you can get back in there is with that recovery key if you cannot remember your password. So first thing, don't forget your admin or your login password for your Mac. Second thing, make sure you have that recovery key. And if you are going to enable File Vault, make sure that you are using a user password that is a good secure password, right? Don't use your pet's name or the name of the street that you grew up on or any of those sorts of things. Don't use any regular words. You know, all the rules that we talk about when picking a good password. Have 1Password generate you a good secure password and commit that thing to memory. And of course, you'll have the recovery key as a backup. Once it shows you the recovery key, it will also ask you if you'd like to store the key with Apple. So that's another way you can do it. If you want to trust Apple with that key, You can have them store the key. It'll ask you a series of questions if you choose to have Apple store the key for you. So different security questions. Another great tip on security questions, pick nonsense answers. So they can be real questions like, what's the name of your first pet? But say make an answer like rutabaga or something that just doesn't make any sense for that question. And again, remember what that answer is, right? That's just the key. You have to be able to remember this stuff to be able to get access back to it. But don't make it easy for someone to be able to guess what that information is, is the general rule. Once you've turned that on and you have the recovery keys all stored away safely, then you'll restart your Mac. That will begin the encryption process. That process can actually take a while depending upon the size of your volume. If you want to follow the encryption progress, you can actually go into the File Vault tab under the Security and Privacy Preference pane and see the progress there. Once it's completed, though, your drive will be encrypted and safe. Again, any time that you're not logged in. So you want to make sure that your Mac is never unlocked if you're going to be away from it. So you probably want to require a password when waking from sleep. You can do that in the System Preferences under Security, Privacy, General. You also want to make sure that you turn off auto login. You don't want it to automatically log into your Mac when you boot it up, because if somebody were to steal it, it would boot up. It would be logged in with your user account and the drive would be totally unencrypted. They'd have access to everything. So again, make sure you turn that off from the System Preferences, Security and Privacy General pane. You also should be aware that even if you're using File Vault to encrypt your drive, if you're using a cloned backup system like Carbon Copy Cloner or SuperDuper, those are going to operate when the drive is unencrypted. So you're not going to have encrypted versions of those backups. Time Machine backups actually can be encrypted. To do that, you need to go into System Preferences, into Time Machine, select your Time Machine drive, and check the box that says Encrypt Backups. SuperDuper and some of the clone backups can be encrypted in other ways. You can find information about how to do that online. Just do a little bit of Googling on encrypting cloned backups, and you should be able to find some information there. Maybe it's a topic we can cover on future episodes of the MacCast. A couple of other just security things to think about. Justin reminds us that relying on Apple's keychain can also be risky if an attacker has physical access to your hard drive. So if you stored all your usernames and passwords in your keychain, just know that someone, if they've gained physical access, even though that stuff's encrypted, they can bang away on that thing. And there's some ways to actually hack into the keychain. One of the things, again, you'll want to make sure, because the keychain is unlocked with your login credentials, make sure, again, that those are really secure, that you use a good, strong password. But even in doing that, given enough time and resources, a brute force hack on, you know, the physical drive could eventually yield a result for an attacker. So you'll want to especially avoid storing things like your encrypted disk image passwords inside the keychain. Just commit those things to memory and enter them every time you need to mount that encrypted disk image. That's more secure than storing it in the keyboard in the keychain. And like all things with security, you have to gauge how much protection you want versus how much convenience. Every time that you do something that's a little more convenient, just recognize that that's a little less secure. And that's kind of a general rule that we've, you know, talked about from time to time here on the MacCast. Now, another thing that came up with this hard drive theft was, why was it sort of carried out this way? You know, to me, I think I joked on the last episode that it seemed almost like an espionage kind of thing, like somebody wanted that data. They wanted to take the drive out. I mean, they took the time to open his Mac up, swap out the SSD drive for a spindle drive. And I thought that was a little bit weird, but it turns out several of you said to me that's not all that strange, that this is actually something that's been going on. And there could be a couple rationales and reasons why a thief might want to do it this way. One of them is, this seems to be carried out at hotels and on people when they're on vacation and traveling with their electronics. So the theory here is that you're less likely to notice that there's been a theft, because maybe you're out and about, you're not using your machine all that often, so an attacker could come in, you come back, they take the drive and the data, say, to steal your identity or your information, you still see your computer sitting there. So you think everything's fine. You don't realize till later something's happened. And even then, you might not know exactly what happened. You might just think that your hard drive was corrupted, because if they just put in a blank formatted drive like they did in the case of this listener's drive, you just think, oh, it must have broke or failed or something like that, and you deal with it when you get home. So the other advantage for a thief is you don't report the theft until much later, and by that time they're long gone and they have a less likelihood of being caught. Another potential theory is that in some cases, hackers, specifically in China and Russia, have been swapping drives, cloning and swapping the drives, and installing spyware and malware to try and gain and get access to additional information like your logins and passwords and stuff like that. So you don't even realize that your hard drive's been swapped out because all the data and information is there. Meanwhile, they've installed keyloggers and other systems to actually phone home and things like that. So that would be another reason why, if you're traveling, as I mentioned in the last episode, if you have an opportunity or the ability to lock your devices up in, say, like a room safe, or maybe even lock it up in the safe down in the lobby, you know, just ask the front desk if they have a safe you could lock it up in. You may consider doing that when traveling with your electronics. But just a little follow-up from the last episode. And once again, I apologize for kind of the misinformation that was given out on that episode. Another thing we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast was the rumor that the iPad may get a split screen mode. And it turned out that it looks like that functionality may be there in iOS 8, but disabled. One developer was actually able to turn it on and go through having a 1/4, 3/4, and half screen split screen mode in his iOS device. And I had argued that I really don't see myself potentially using that feature all that much. I think the iPad screen, even at 9.7 inches, is not big enough to really warrant, you know, the functionality or the need to kind of have a split screen. And I was curious because there are some split screen devices out on the market. I think some Android tablets and specifically Microsoft Surface tablets do support that feature. It's something Microsoft has actually heavily advertised when they were advertising those devices as an advantage of the Microsoft solution over an iPad. And so I asked anybody out in our audience, hey, write in if you use that feature and find it particularly useful. Well, I actually got one person who emailed me back and said, yeah, I love that feature. I use it a lot. It came from Jason, and he said, I am one of those rare Surface RT users, and I make heavy usage of the split screen functionality. I will admit up front that I don't really use the Surface as a production device, except for taking notes in OneNote during meetings. For the most part, I use the device as a research and media consumption device, and for that, the split screen feature sees a lot of use. One of the main reasons I switched to the Surface RT from the iPad, aside from the ridiculous education deal that I got on it, was that I multitask a lot when watching any kind of video. I found myself constantly using my iPhone to check IRC, Twitter, etc., and switching to the Surface allowed me to just split the window at 50% for IRC and 25% for Twitter and save my iPhone battery. I also do a lot of research, and I have a browser on one side and video playing on the other. So I can certainly see where those kinds of applications you know, could benefit. Personally, again, I don't know that I'd want my video playing, you know, on one half of the screen in a little small window just to also be able to Twitter at the same time. But really, that's just me. So I do see the application. I think what I'm kind of responding to is I just don't know that it would be a heavily used feature. I guess having the option doesn't prevent me from using my iPad the way I want and opens up other people to be able to use their iPad the way they want with split screen. I just tend to find that those things are more of a distraction. For example, even on my 15-inch MacBook Pro screen, I tend to run my apps in a maximized window, and I use the command tab feature to kind of fast switch between them. It's almost more like the way I use my apps on my iPad, right? I have a full screen app, I double tap, and I fast user switch to get back and forth between them because I really want that full screen real estate. But, you know, to each their own, and I really appreciate, Jason, you actually writing in and explaining how you use that feature. So it sounds like maybe this is something that could bring you back to the iPad. And I think maybe that's what Apple is really going for. And hopefully Apple puts their little flavor and their taste and spin on it. The early things that we saw with this developer enabling the feature, it was kind of clunky and kludgy. I don't think it's finished. And we had been hearing rumors that it actually might not make it into the first release of iOS 8, that it might be more of an iOS 8.1 or 8.2 feature showing up later. And maybe that's because Apple wants to really take the time to kind of finesse it. And I could see myself potentially using it with my RSS feeds and my notes, because I do a lot of times have to copy and paste back and forth. But once again, on the smaller screen, I don't know that I have enough room to really get in and read my RSS feed if it was only on half of the 9.7-inch screen. Some people are arguing that this is a feature that makes more sense if Apple does come out with an iPad Pro, like a 12 or a 13-inch version of the iPad, and maybe I'll have to rethink things there. But once again, I still even find on my 15-inch MacBook Pro, I really like to maximize my apps on the screen, and I'm generally not working in that whole side-by-side scenario. So if any of you would like to chime in on this conversation like Jason did, tell me I'm wrong. Tell me that, hey, this is a really important feature. I still maintain that Apple will throw it out there and it will be a what I call a 5%er, right? 5% of the people will kind of use it. The rest of us won't. And I threw out the example of I can never even remember what it's called. Not the dashboard, the application launcher that Apple has in Mac OS X. Now I got to go look at the application menu. I can never remember the name of the name of the thing. What's it called? The Launchpad. I never used the Launchpad, and I did get an email from one of you, once again, who said you actually use the Launchpad and like it a lot when you download new applications. The only time I ever see it is when I download a new app from the App Store and, you know, it automatically loads in there and you kind of watch the progress a little bit. But beyond that, never use that feature. I'm totally a Spotlight application launcher through and through. So, again, one of those 5% features. I guess the reality is, like I said, there's no harm in having it, but once again, I just don't see it being all that useful. Last time we talked about a potential gotcha with Apple's Reminders application, I received an email from Carlos, and he was explaining how he was having issues and felt that there was a bug in what I thought was Reminders, basically. And what I discovered was that Reminders in Mac, in Mac OS X, will adjust based on your time zone, which in most cases I think you want, but in some cases you might not want. You might want a reminder that goes off at a specific time every day, regardless of which time zone you're in, and isn't adjusted that way. And so we kind of talked about that a little bit and covered some different ways that you could handle that. But Carlos got back to me and said, no, you misunderstood what I was telling you about. And initially, when I received the email, I did think that he was talking about a bug with Apple's timer. So, you know, you go into the clock application, you can set a timer, and it's supposed to go off at a certain time. Carlos confirmed that that was what he was talking about, but I guess what happened was when I was testing his bug, I set my timer just for a couple minutes. And really, the bug that he was talking about comes into play if you have a timer that's longer than an hour in duration. So if it's over an hour, what the bug actually is that you'll set the timer, say, for 3 hours. And you can try this on your iOS device. It's actually able to confirm that there's this weird little bug in iOS right now. You go into settings, you go into general after setting your timer, you go into the date and time, and now change your time zone. So if you have it set to go automatically, you can turn that off for a second, set it to another time zone, and then go ahead and lock your iOS device, put it to sleep. And when you tap the sleep-wake button to wake it back up, what you'll see is you'll see the timer counting down on the lock screen, but it will actually be adjusted for the time zone. So it'll add a couple hours or remove, it will just be off. If you've changed your time zone since setting that timer. Obviously, now your timer is going to be way off from when you set it. So in Carlos's case, he was saying, you know, I set it for 10 hours. I go on a trip, a flight, and then the timer, you know, it doesn't look right on the lock screen. If you actually go ahead and wake up your device and go back into the clock, you'll see within the clock application itself, it still is accurate. Now, I didn't wait long enough to find out, you know, after an hour, if it would go off at the right time. I probably should do that. I think Carlos said it doesn't. If you've changed time zone, it'll actually throw the timer off, even though in the clock app itself, it's accurate. Maybe it's a difference of if you don't have your device awake when the timer reaches its time, then it honors what's on the lock screen versus if the phone is actually on and not in lock mode, maybe it honors what's in the clock. I really don't know. But if you go ahead and change the time zone back, you'll notice that the timer on the lock screen will become accurate again. It'll be actually set to the time and the countdown that you already had it set for. So if you play around with this and take a look at this bug, don't forget to change your time zone back because it'll throw other things off on your device. But definitely a bug that Carlos ran across and a weird one. So Carlos, you should, and I think you already did this, but anybody who comes across a bug like this, make sure you go to apple.com/feedback and just let Apple and the engineers and the folks in support know about the bug. Chances are they may or may not already know about it, but the more people who notice it and mention it, I think the higher priority it gets in terms of being fixed. So hopefully Apple will fix this in the next update, which we've heard this past week is pushed out to developers. So we may see an update to OS X Mavericks, I think 9.4.1. Is that where we're at? Current version is 9.3, so 9.4 may be on its way here pretty soon. Kevin says he suddenly can't understand his iTunes, that it's actually speaking a different language, and he didn't really change anything. He didn't touch his international settings. He didn't change his language in his Mac whatsoever, and he wants to know what's going on. Kevin, I've actually run across this thing. So what's really happening to explain this to the rest of you who can't read my mind, Kevin wrote in and said, suddenly the tracks in his iTunes library were showing the artist information in Chinese, a completely different language, despite the fact that his Mac is totally set to be in English. And he wants to kind of know what's going on and why this is happening. And Kevin, I've actually run into this kind of situation in the past, and it generally has to do with the Unicode character set. And I'll get to how that works with fonts and stuff like that in a second here. But the very first thing I would check is double check and make sure for some reason your language settings didn't get off for some reason. So if you go into System Preferences and go into the Language Region Settings, you want to make sure that your preferred language is at the top of the list there. There's a little plus and minus button if you want to add or remove languages. You can also click and drag the languages into a specific order. So just make sure that English is up there as the top language. I've seen it where for some reason the language gets flipped, and then some applications tend to prefer the first choice or the preferred language, and that could be happening with iTunes. So you want to quit out of iTunes, double check that setting, make sure it's right, and open up iTunes. If that's the case, if it was just, you know, Chinese for some reason was above English in that list, that could be part of your problem. But I have a feeling that's really not what's going on here. The more likely thing that I think is happening, and I've seen this happen, is you've installed some program or something and it installed some new fonts, and you now have like a Unicode font conflict kind of issue. And you're going to have to do a little research and troubleshooting to kind of figure out what's going on. Luckily, Apple's FontBook application should be able to help. So go into Applications, open up FontBook, and then just scroll through the list and see if you have any conflicts in that list. You should see, if you do, a little kind of yellow warning icon, and you can click on that and see what fonts might be conflicting and see if you don't have like a Chinese font conflicting with maybe one of your system fonts. And if you do, just go ahead and select that, and in FontBook you can actually disable that other font, and hopefully that will clean things up. Another thing you might look for is any kind of duplicate fonts. It may be that it thinks some sort of weird Chinese Unicode font is duplicated with one of your main fonts. If you go under the Edit menu, there's a Look for Enabled Duplicates option, and it should be able to show you any duplicate conflicts there. Again, just disable any ones that might be in conflict. And then if you want to get really extreme, you can go under the edit menu and just disable all of the user installed fonts. So any fonts that would be installed in your user account, there's a disable user option. You can pick that. It will turn off in Fontbook all of the user fonts, and then just relaunch iTunes and see if the problem resolves itself. If it does, then you know you have some sort of conflict in one of your user fonts, so you can just go through and turn on the user fonts that you want sort of one by one. Feels a little bit old school, like the whole conflict catcher extensions things we had to do back in the OS 9 days, if you were around then. I don't know how old you are, so if you've been around long enough to know what I'm talking about, you're groaning right now. But yeah, it's a similar kind of troubleshooting process. So those are the things that I would take a look at, and hopefully it's one of those. If not, write me back, or if you've run across this problem and you know that the fixes that I'm recommending aren't right, let me know what the right answer is. But I did a little Googling around, and I couldn't find too much on this issue, and I'm guessing, Kevin, you did the same thing, which is why you turned to the MacCast community. So hopefully we can help you out. Just as a side note, a somewhat related issue that might crop up from time to time is if you're in iTunes and you're only seeing a different language in the iTunes store, you might want to check and make sure that somehow you didn't get your store settings changed to a different country. So if you open up the iTunes store, just in iTunes, click on the iTunes store button, and you see that different language, scroll all the way to the bottom of the main iTunes store window, and down in the lower right-hand corner, you should see a little flag icon. It should be the flag for your country of choice. If it's not, go ahead and click on it, and you'll get a list of all the available countries for iTunes. And you can check those on, find the one that's appropriate for you, select it, and that should turn the iTunes store back to your preferred language. So, Kevin, good luck with your issue, and hope that helps you out. We've been talking a bit about Thunderbolt docking stations for Mac, and I think we had a review, someone write in and talk about the Belkin Thunderbolt station, and I asked you for additional reviews if any of you out there had some of the other models, and I received this review from Ty on the CalDigit Thunderbolt station.
Hey Adam, this is Ty from Provo, Utah. Just wanted to give a review on the CalDigit Thunderbolt station. The station has a HDMI port, two Thunderbolt ports, an Ethernet port, three USB ports, and a audio in and out jack. And I was getting it primarily for two displays. But I did not realize that you cannot have, on this particular station, you cannot have an HDMI monitor as well as a mini DisplayPort monitor. You have to have an HDMI monitor or with an adapter. It works with an adapter, so you could have like HDMI to DVI, but your Thunderbolt port has to be a Thunderbolt monitor. So that takes you down to just a handful of monitors that I know of. It'd probably be a good thing to review if someone's going to get this. So you'd have to get there's the two Apple monitors, and then I looked through, and there was one I wasn't sure about. It was an Asus monitor. It didn't say Thunderbolt, but it says not mini DisplayPort. It says DisplayPort on it. So I'm thinking that it is a Thunderbolt port, but I'm not sure. So that would be interesting to know the difference between DisplayPort and a Thunderbolt port, if there is a difference, or they just don't call it Thunderbolt like Apple does. So overall, it works great. It did everything I wanted to do except for the monitor, having two monitors at the same time. So just thought I'd give you that review, and love the show. Talk to you later. Bye.
Hey, Ty, thanks so much for the review and for your comments on the CalDigit thing, specifically regarding the monitors. The fact that it has two Thunderbolt connectors, I would have thought also, as long as your Mac supported it, that it would be able to connect two different monitors. And I am really baffled a little bit by your comment about the distinction between a Thunderbolt monitor, Apple's Thunderbolt monitor, versus a monitor that would connect up with mini DisplayPort. Because in essence, Thunderbolt is a mini DisplayPort combined with basically a PCIe external bus sort of thing. That's the best way to describe it. I know I'm ultra simplifying it, but basically with Thunderbolt, you have kind of the two different technologies going over the same cable. You have data being carried along with the video signal, and that video is Mini DisplayPort. So Mini DisplayPort Thunderbolts, I would think it really wouldn't make a difference. So I don't know if Apple's doing something different in its monitor that allows it to operate with that HDMI. The first thing that I was thinking of is, you know, you can only have one DisplayPort monitor or one monitor per Thunderbolt bus. So even though you can daisy chain Thunderbolt devices, you cannot have two monitors in a daisy chain. You need to have the monitor at the end of the chain. So that would be a limitation. And I thought, well, maybe the HDMI bus and the Thunderbolt bus are sharing the same bus. So it recognizes, oh, you've already got one monitor attached. You can only have one connected at a time. But then that would also, I would think, hold true even with an Apple, you know, Thunderbolt display connected on there. So why the difference? I have no idea. But it sounds like with that CalDigit, you can connect a Thunderbolt monitor and an HDMI monitor together, and even a DVI monitor using an HDMI to DVI adapter, or I would assume an HDMI to any other kind of adapter for a display. So if you wanted to go to VGA or some other kind of connector, probably even Mini DisplayPort if you needed to do that for some reason, then that would work. But it sounds like for whatever reason, you cannot connect HDMI along with another type of display that's not an Apple Thunderbolt display. So if anybody happens to know why specifically that is, like what is special or different about Apple's Thunderbolt display, I tried to find the answer, but I could not find anything when I was actually doing my Googling. So that is a mystery for sure, Ty. And then finally, for the MacCast for today, I have a little trick for you that came in from listener Ian. You know, many of us are excited about OS X Yosemite and some of the visual design changes. One of those design changes is a significant change to the dock, specifically if you access the dock from the bottom of your screen rather than the left or right-hand side. It has kind of a new 2D view that looks a lot actually like the side views. So if you want to get a feel for what this might look like, if you just go into the little divider between your applications and your document folders and the trash and control-click or right-click in the dock on that little line, you can select the position on option. And if you change it from bottom to left or right, you'll kind of see the 2D version of the dock. And that's what the dock's going to look like at the bottom of the screen as well, pretty much in OS X Mavericks. Well, Ian, or OS X Yosemite rather, well, Ian wanted to get that look in Mavericks without having to actually install OS X Yosemite and join up with the beta program. So he was resourceful. He did a little bit of Googling around, and he found a project called CDock that allows you to tweak the visual look of your dock. And I think this has been around for a little while, and he sent me a screenshot. He was actually able to achieve a pretty good facsimile of what OS X Yosemite might look like, including he found a copy of the OS X Yosemite desktop and installed that on his Mavericks system. So visually, it looked very, very similar. Now, I'm going to mention this project and give a couple of different warnings. One is that this tool seems to do some pretty heavy tweaking to the dock. I'm not sure exactly how it's achieving it, but I do know that it's using a technology called Symbol, which has been around for a while, or the Simple Bundle Loader or Smart Input Manager Bundle Loader. It's something that is in OS X, and it lets third-party developers basically tweak the input manager system. And I've never been a huge fan of Symbol hacks, but they're around. They've been used by a lot of people for a very long time, but they will tweak things in your system. So I would definitely recommend before you try this that you do a backup. The other thing that I wanted to point out is that the app, when you download it, is unsigned, and it comes from SourceForge. I generally don't advise running unsigned apps. You want an app that's signed by the developer for security reasons, but I did try it out, and it seemed to be okay, but again, I'm not a security expert, so there is a potential security risk in sort of running this thing. And I also did run into a small issue when I first ran the app, and had it swap out my dock. It's probably because I normally run with my dock on the side, and when I did it, it kind of locked up the dock. I had to reset it, get it moved back down to the bottom, and then once I did that, it seemed to run and function just fine. But basically what the app does, and my best guess as to what it does, is simply swap out some of the PNG, some of the image resource files that go into making up the visual look of your dock. You can actually see these files in your system. If you go into the main system library folder, under core services, there's a dock.app. And if you right-click or control-click on it and show the app contents, there's actually little resource files in there in the contents resources folder, and you can see the PNGs. So it actually is very likely either hacking the dock application itself or superseding the dock application using that symbol technology. So it's a pretty heavy tweak. I wouldn't use it lightly, but if you're brave and want to play around with it, go for it. It didn't seem to cause any problems on my Mac, and there is a uninstaller or reset option. So you can reset it and restore it back to the original dock, which I would assume swaps out all the files. But basically, once you run the application, it gives you some options. You can have a transparent dock, so you can get rid of the background completely and just kind of have the floating icons. It has some various customized looks that you can tweak different text values, so you can change and tweak the colors and play with all kinds of parameters just by adjusting and editing this little text file. And it does come with some preset text files that you can load in. There's a mode called full screen, which actually extends your entire dock across the entire bottom of the screen. So if you want to have, you know, like the smoke background all the way from edge to edge on the bottom of your screen, you can do that with this application. So it does provide and give you some fun visual tweaks. And if you do get stuck, I mentioned earlier that I kind of, the first time I ran it, got locked up in my dock a little bit. Just remember, you can always reset and relaunch the dock application by using the terminal command kill all. So if you do kill all space dash kill space dock in the terminal and hit return, that will quit and restart your dock. And I'll have that command in the show notes at maccast.com so you can see it all written out. But that's just a general useful trick if you ever have a dock that appears to be locked up as well. You can restart the dock application that way. But Ian said he's been using it and has not had any troubles with the CDock application. So with the caveat and warnings, you can check it out and see if that's something you might want to play around with. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their software and get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can check it out and get a free trial over at lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. All of the bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly at cashfly.com, and advertising is handled by Backbeat Media at backbeatmedia.com. Big thank you to you for listening, for staying subscribed. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You're also welcome to leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype handle is the MacCast. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. Also check out the Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And check out the MacCast Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you'll find us there. And with that, that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.